Welcome to The Process Podcast, an interview series focused on the process of survival as a creative. Season 6 features conversations with visual artists and curators and gallerists from the Bay Area of California. These conversations took place during a 3-month-long residency at the Growlery, an incredible organization based in San Francisco, who facilitated many of these conversations. They can be found at thegrowlery.org. We have also launched a Patreon for those who want to and are able to provide some financial support for the show to help us keep going. You can learn more about why we've launched that and where the money goes and how it will help us grow at patreon.com/theprocessco. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you dig the season. Cheers, y'all.
Hello. This episode is a conversation with Bay Area photographer Carrie Orbick, who's originally from Alaska and one of my personal favorite modern photographers. Carrie has used the historic wet plate collodion process as a method for over 10 years, a language she uses both inside and outside of the studio. She also shoots on film and digitally and tends to use multiple formats when she's working. Carrie runs a tintype studio that she does portraits and other types of photos, and also has done much fine art photography on various topics, many of which you'll hear us talk about. She produced a body of work around tightroping that's super rad. Her work has been shown in the Berkeley Art Museum, the Headland Center for the Arts, where she was a graduate fellow, SF Camera Work, SOMARTS, and the cover of San Francisco Magazine, as well as a bunch of other places. She also has an exhibit coming up at SF Camera Work on October 10th, where she'll be exhibiting some of her Geneva work, which we also get into. She has an interesting background story. She used to work in social work, and that has very much influenced her work and definitely ties into her love of working with people. We also cover her experience at Berkeley's free MFA program, some advice around making maybe different financial choices as a developing professional, why working for affordable housing influenced her to become a photographer, her desire to remember the impact that a single person has, how her work speaks to the presence and absence that's happening simultaneously in our world, the wet plate collodion process itself, and a whole lot more. We talk about teaching, we talk about acknowledging your own voice and strength that you bring to a situation versus remaining neutral, and a whole lot more. Really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you did too. Find detailed show notes at theprocess.co. Hope you dig it. Check you next week. Cheers, y'all.
Out of all the work you do, is there a particular part of it that you love the most or feel most passionate about? Whether it's the stuff that makes money or not.
I mean, there's the stuff that makes money, and I think that I need to kind of reclaim some of my time for myself and my relationship and just like being a human being, because I have definitely just like put my head down and not looked up for a few years now. And part of that initially was financially motivated, just to like pay my bills and make a living. But when I kind of stepped back, I realized like I love every single part of what I do. And I always wanted to have a portrait studio. And I'm like every day kind of amazed by who I meet that I would never have met otherwise. And like you meet someone and you might have an impression, but I always try to stay really open, because 99.9% of the time, it's like people are always pleasantly surprising me.
Yeah.
It's happened so many hundreds of probably thousands of times at this point in terms of all the people that I've met that I've photographed, that it's like this really reliable fact that you can find common ground with people. And I mean, self-selecting, so it's not like there's probably some limit that has already been placed on the interaction, you know? But it's still what I love about having a portrait studio. So I would never not want to have it, even though I might, you know, lose the space at some point and I don't know where else I would do it.
Right.
But I would probably set them up different places, but that's a lot of work. Anyway, so that part I love as part of my week. And I'm a nerd. I like working with the chemistry. So just that kind of daily interaction with the kind of mechanics of photography keeps it as like, I mean, it's literally all over me all the time, sadly, but I like it. So it makes me happy. And then the teaching, even though it takes a lot of energy, I'm always learning, you know, like even just remembering things about photography or myself or whatever that I'd forgotten in order to explain it to someone else. It's like, I find it really like rewarding. And then to see people connecting into the things that they love through photography is also really rewarding for me. So that part, I'm down. And then my practice, it's almost like it consumes my thoughts all the time. And it's probably like the most tortured part of my artistic week, but it's compulsive and I can't not do it. So I feel like each part of what I do is, it's almost like I can't live without it, even though I'm happy to take breaks and
maybe go for a bit, take a vacation.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. But just as an example, so this was 5 years ago, maybe, but when I finished grad school, before that, my family lives in Norway, and I had gone there, and coming back, I'd imagined setting up a rope from where my family lives out to a rock over the water and walking on it, because that's what it felt like to be there. And so I found someone here in San Francisco to teach me to walk on a tightrope. And I returned the next year and did that.
Oh, wow.
And it turned out that my dad's old neighbor, like on the farm next door, had also done tightrope walking when he was younger. So he actually had a tightrope in his yard, and my cousins were like, oh, you should go talk to him. So he helped me set it up, like the actual structure and the rope. And, you know, probably only 10 people were there, just kind of family members who wanted to see it. And it changed nothing in any practical way, but I was so like driven to make this happen that there was no kind of question in my mind that I was going to do it. And then when I did it, I felt like all the reasons I'd wanted to do it was how I felt afterwards, but I could have never known that that's what it was going to look like or feel like. So then when I had the studio at the Headlands for that next year, I just kind of went with it. I didn't go anywhere. Yeah. I was like literally walking back and forth and doing all these ridiculous exercises and trying different stuff with the camera and the tintypes and video. And it was like the most kind of freeing and generative year of making work. And again, that's something that I kind of like look back on because I know that that's possible. So it's hard to get the space and time, you know, not making money to allow yourself to give that time to it. But I think that's the beauty of a residency is that you really make that a priority, and you can't do it all the time. But for me, it's really productive. So Recology was really productive, and other residencies that I've done have been that way.
So are your parents Norwegian?
My dad was Norwegian, and both my sisters lived there.
When you did the tightroping, did you go literally to a rock? Or did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. And my cousin, my cousin is a photographer, but he had gotten this really nice zoom lens. So you can't see.
Oh, no.
It's literally just zoomed on me, and you can't see the ends.
Yeah.
But there's a few photographs, but weirdly, it's like, it's not even that important to me because it was more of like what happened. And then the book that I made afterwards and the work that I did at the Headlands was kind of like the visual part of it.
So at the Headlands, you photographed other people?
No, it's all me.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this was kind of like this, sort of like a Houdini muscle man type character that came out of all these ridiculous exercises that I would do. So this was how I set up the rope in the gym there. So I put stakes in the ground and then threaded the rope up through the second story across the gym.
Oh, wow.
And then cinched it on the other side of the building.
Holy shit, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then I would do different studies with the rope itself. This was my resting pose. It's my philosophical underpinning.
Yeah, I'd imagine you didn't go pretty deep with like trusting the rope
You know, it was less about that. It was more, I felt like it was actually very practical to, my day would be setting up the rope, trying different things on the rope until my, like either with the camera or without, but until my legs would get really like jello-y.
Yeah.
And then I would do, I found this army physical fitness test. And so I would kind of like tire myself out through all those different exercises. And I couldn't do a pull-up, so I just kind of played around with like variations on a pull-up. Yeah. At the end, I would bring my typewriter out to the middle of the gym and type out my thoughts for the day. And I'm really glad I did, because I would have forgotten everything that I had thought about that day.
Totally.
But then I could kind of compile them at the end. And the quote, or like the passage from Hannah Arendt that I wasn't thinking about while I was doing it, but that came to me afterwards, is basically thinking, if you think of yourself with the future, the pressure of the future in front of you and the pressure of the past behind you, that you have the option of looking diagonally or above or below, like that point that you're standing at.
Mm.
And so that's kind of like the perspective, or, but it releases you from being stuck in the moment, and yet you're not divorced from present reality. So it's not an escape, but it's like the possibility of sort of expanding your perception of your situation.
Right.
And then that kind of aptly described what I'd been doing.
Yeah.
And just things like, my dad had, he passed away, but my dad had been a young student when the Nazis had occupied Norway. Mm-hmm. So he's a lot older than me. And he was in the resistance army that was training in Sweden. And that experience of kind of being occupied like that made him very kind of paranoid of kind of big powers taking over. And so he wrote this book about neutrality and kind of that it was impossible. And I think partly with my family situation and partly just kind of my life situation, and also thinking about San Francisco in general and all these kind of polarizing forces here, I think that I was trying to find this like neutral stance that would sort of accommodate everybody.
Yeah.
And I thought that being neutral was actually what allowed you to stay up on the rope. And instead, one day as I was walking on the rope, I realized that it's actually like feeling your own backbone. The strength of that is what was keeping me from not falling off the rope. It doesn't matter, but for me, it was like this shift in my perspective, which is like acknowledging and validating your own voice and the strength that you bring to a situation that is not going to be neutral at all. That was just one day.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like really a really productive, personally, like
huge growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the debt that I incurred from being out there, I did not regret, because I felt like I knew I would never have that time. And it's really hard to get into the gym if you're not like a choreographer, musician. So I felt really lucky that I was able to be in that space.
Yeah. Sounds like it was totally worth it.
Yeah.
This is like a dumb question. But technically, how did, 'cause all those are shot on film, right?
Uh-huh.
How?
Well, some of it is video. Like this is a video still from just being out there. So I just set the camera up.
That was a question.
Yeah.
If you had like an assistant or
yeah.
You.
Yeah.
Like,
so some of them I did a lot with video, and video allows you to kind of just like keep it rolling and then review it afterwards.
Okay.
So that's kind of how I would like map out what I wanted to do. And then I would set things up with my view camera or whatever it was I was using. And then I would have a friend come and help me just like press the shutter. So it's kind of like always figuring out like what time of day I wanted to do it at and how I wanted it to look. And then I would get someone to help me, and always like stuff went wrong. But
yeah, totally. That's
part of it.
Yeah. Are you able to embrace that part of it? Are you pretty good at that?
Well, you know, I taught this alternative processes class at the San Francisco Art Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm telling the students, like, you signed up for all of it. And they're, like, super frustrated with all this, like, chemistry not coming out or the timing or whatever it is. Just, like, their efforts were put forward and it didn't yield what they wanted to have happen. And I'm like, oh.
It's about the process.
Totally.
The journey, not the
exactly. And then right after that, I started the residency at Recology. And I was, like, trying to repurpose some of the chemistry that would come through hazardous waste and, like, try to build my big ass camera. And it was just like all failure all the time. And I was so frustrated and I was trying to, you know, it didn't even help trying to remember, you know, what I would have told my students. But I do think that what I was trying to get them to think about is like that the practice is actually what you're able to come back to. That's the structure that allows you to withstand all of those ups and downs and failures. And that you need something to be able to kind of keep going. Otherwise, it's frustrating all the time. For me, I feel like most of what I do falls short of what I thought it was going to be, but then it leads to something else. And so all of these experiences that I've talked about, I feel like they're all like making this case to have faith in that practice. And if you don't have it, then it's just harder to believe that it's going to work out.
Right. And maybe it's time to reevaluate why you're doing what you're doing.
Totally. Yeah. And it's another thing I tell my students and don't necessarily remember in the moment is like, if you can't find some type of enjoyment from it, there's not a lot of reasons to be an artist. I mean, a lot of people, you know, there's something compulsive and I can relate to that. And there's communication with an audience and there's the process, but there's not a lot of like, you don't get a lot back tangibly.
Right.
And so if you can't find some type of joy in what you're doing, it's like maybe a good time to reevaluate.
Yeah.
Felt like grad school was just torture.
Because it was constant outside evaluation. Why was it?
Yeah,
there's a lot of learning and failing.
Evaluation and critique and kind of second guessing your instincts.
Yeah.
So that was another nice thing about the timing. It was the last time I was in Norway and I'd done that tightrope, had that experience, but it was also right after grad school. So I didn't really even tell anyone much about what I was doing. I just really like focused on being there. And that was another thing that I tell my students, like you can't be the critic and the creator at the same time, but easier said than done.
Totally. Well, it's kind of an instructor's job to say all that stuff, even if it's kind of hurts to say it sometimes. The residencies I've done, I feel I always have to do like client work too, which is probably because I've been terrible with money in the past and not good at saving. But yeah, I would love, my goal one day is to like get my act together and be able to go to a residency and just do my art or like only focus on this, not have to do any of that.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, the time is shorter, but.
Right, maybe it's like 10 days instead of a month.
Yeah.
Totally. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you a little bit about kind of the business side of things.
Okay.
Like, how do your portrait clients find you? Or do you find them?
The World Wide Web.
Yeah, so is it people like Googling portrait studio?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of word of mouth, or somebody will share it on social media. Instagram seemed to be like really helpful.
Has that changed? Have you seen any of the decline stuff that everyone's been talking about?
Decline?
Like less engagement from Instagram, less people.
Well, I don't engage with Instagram as much. I like. Pretty much every day is a good day when I don't post anything. It's sad, but it's like I really have to kind of force myself to put something on there. I should probably just get another account where I don't care or, you know, don't think about it as much. But in a perfect world, I would never post anything.
But it is a pretty big.
But I'm happy like when other people do. And when I do, you know, there's like, rapport relationships that come out of that. So
What does the process look like from when someone books an appointment with you to the end of taking their portrait? Like you mentioned, you've met a lot of people who've surprised you, or like you love the people that you interact with.
Well, so someone will email to schedule an appointment. Sometimes there's like, you know, some back and forth to make that happen. Especially when I was teaching, that was like brutal to just find time to schedule. Then what happens? People show up. I ask them usually to bring some variety, you know, of clothing with them, so we have something to choose from. And then we just talk kind of about what they had in mind, how they kind of showed up there. And usually there's something kind of personal about it. Sometimes people will be marking like a certain time in their life, or some event would have happened, or it's an anniversary or birthday or something. So there's something kind of commemorative already about showing up, I think, especially when there's more than one person. I think that there's different dynamics that happen, like families and stuff, but it's usually something that they haven't done before. So there's something kind of like that they're learning, or it's a new experience for them.
Yeah.
And some people I've photographed like for the last 7 years, every year.
Cool.
So that's like, you know, like thinking about what's changed since the last year, and, you know, things like that.
Totally. How to capture that. Cool. So audio stuff. Type of audio editing, what are you doing?
Oh, I learned just really cursory software. It was Final Cut at the time, because when I decided to quit my job at a nonprofit and go to grad school, which was the free MFA program at Berkeley.
Mm.
And I liked that it was interdisciplinary, and obviously that there was no tuition.
Wait, there's a free MFA? I was just saying last night, or the other night, how Berkeley is like my dream school if I ever went back to school, and how I could never afford it.
Well, yeah, that's in the art practice department. The journalism school is not free. I mean, I think there's a handful of scholarships. Anyway, I think a lot of people go back to grad school when they are ready to kind of make a change or see what would happen if they tried something different. And I was always doing my photo projects on the side and working full time. So I felt like I wanted to see what would happen if I devoted more time. And I wanted to add audio and movement to photography and just see what would happen.
Yeah.
I felt really lucky to take classes in the geography department. One was about the cultural landscape. I took another class in the journalism school. And it was kind of like summer camp, to just not be, you know, working 9 to 5 at a job and learning.
Yeah.
So I felt really lucky for that opportunity. But I feel like once I left my full-time job, it was kind of this like ongoing financial free fall of like just seeing what would happen and kind of holding my breath. And since it was a tuition-free education, I think I didn't realize how much the just like living expenses would add up.
Yeah.
So those are kind of like still with me.
Yeah.
In the form of debt.
Yeah.
So I don't regret any of my experiences, but I kind of wish I had made wiser financial choices, because that's like 5 years ago now. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's 9 years ago. So
yeah.
So it's become more of a priority, I guess, to try to like stabilize my life financially. Whereas before it was like all for the vision and the experience, so and the material or whatever it was.
I think that's pretty common though, right?
Yeah, but I also think that it's a sacrifice that kind of like is expected, and I don't think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And it also kind of allows the experience to take those risks. Kind of prioritizes people who have a safety net.
Right.
Or if you don't, that you're kind of racking up all this debt to kind of live your dream.
Yeah.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. That was me last year, so I can relate.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the best years of grad school was actually when I left. So the Headland Center for the Arts gives a grad studio to each art program, art school. So I got it for UC Berkeley and had a studio out at the Headlands for a year. And I was only working part-time and not making that much money. I was actually shooting tintype portraits at Photo Booth, which was a tintype portrait studio in Valencia, and then just decided that I would try to be out at the studio as much as possible and basically put like gas, food, and bridge tolls on my credit card.
Yeah.
And so I don't regret it, but it's still with me.
Right. Yeah. What was the vision when you went to grad school?
Oh, well, like I said, it was just to kind of try something different, mm-hmm. and really like cast a wide net. And it's an interdisciplinary program, and I feel like most people kind of tried all these different things and after they left went back to doing like what they were doing before.
Yeah.
I mean, with an expanded perspective. But yeah, I was like, I think I'm a photographer.
Yeah. What were you doing at the nonprofit?
It was the Lighthouse for the Blind, and so I actually organized this art show of blind artists for 8 years in the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery in City Hall. So it was this kind of all-encompassing exhibition where we had touchable sculpture and led touchable art tours. There was like accessible audio tours, and we would get like acoustic guide to donate players. So there was a guided tour through the exhibition. We outreached to a lot of community groups. And then I had a artist day where a lot of the artists could come together for like the day of the opening, meet each other and kind of like share resources and challenges, etc. Because a lot of people were kind of isolated wherever they were working, and just like a good community building activity. So I was kind of all about that for a while. And then I did marketing also for an outreach for the Lighthouse for the Blind. A lot of senior fairs.
Sounds kind of like your classic nonprofit, all hands on deck.
Yeah. I mean, the Lighthouse is a pretty big nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Before that, I worked in affordable housing, and that's really what I guess influenced me becoming a photographer, because a lot of people passed away during the time that I worked at the building, and there wasn't a lot of actual imagery of them. It was kind of before cell phones, so we'd like look through a box to find a blurry Polaroid of somebody, just to remember them by. And so I was taking these photo classes at City College, actually to defer my student loans for my undergrad, and got really into photography and learning about lighting, studio equipment, etc. And so I would set up portrait studios at the building, and that's kind of like was my first project, I guess, so that there would be, it was voluntary. Anyone who wanted to could show up and get a portrait. And I think I asked them for like $3 because everything was on film. So I was paying for it all myself. And I remember this one guy who sadly passed away, but he was like, I'm going to give you $5 because this is a really good portrait. So that was like very meaningful. The building was in South Park in San Francisco, and there were all these startups or dot-coms at the time that kind of like were there and then they disappeared. But it was just this stark contrast between people who were just trying to maintain their housing and people who were kind of living a lot more comfortably in the city.
You had kind of a front row seat.
Yeah, definitely. And also just that desire to remember kind of the impact that people had on whether it was my life or someone else's, and then their belongings would be left, have to decide in some cases what to do with them. And I feel like that's always around me. I'm always kind of looking at what's left over and what's disappeared and how you, I guess, work through that like presence and absence that's always simultaneously happening.
Yeah.
So that's why I've been excited about applying this historic chemistry, the collodion, wet plate collodion chemistry, to translucent materials like found glass and plastic. Because when the image is in front of a black background, you can see it as a positive. But when you remove that dark background, the image kind of disappears and becomes a negative. So all of that is like latent within the image. It's just kind of depending on the setting and how you look at it, etc.
Are you capturing different both versions?
Yeah, you know, I had the recology residency, which is at the San Francisco dump, this past summer, which was really intense experience. Pretty immersive and totally the opposite of the Headlands, where it's like you like go through the tunnel and you're in this kind of inspiring, expansive, sublime nature. And at the dump, you're kind of like blown away by the wind, and there's like trash everywhere,
yeah,
and dust, and it's a lot of noises. So it's really hard. They power washed the recycling cans right next to the studio. So it's just this like kind of really intense noise. So I found it hard to think while I was there. Whereas at the Headlands, I'm like, my mind was open and physically I was feeling really invigorated.
At the dump, was it like you're going to the studio every day?
Yeah, I mean, I was teaching at, I teach at City College. So I was teaching a class and also working in the darkroom there, the issue room photo lab, where I took classes like 18 years ago. And some of the same teachers and staff are still there. So it's a trip to be there on the other side, giving out penalty warnings and stuff like that.
What do you obviously do?
Really large cluster of keys.
Yeah. What are you teaching specifically?
So I've taught beginning photography, which is all digital, although some people choose to shoot film. I taught a self-portraiture class this summer that was really good and also interesting to teach at this point when there's... Exactly. So just to... I actually took one at City College, whatever it was, 17 years ago. So it is a different moment to be talking about it. But one of the... Well, totally. And my first assignment was for the students to pick a partner and interview each other and then use some aspect of what they learned in the interview and photograph themselves as the other person so that they, it kind of took the pressure off of this true or flattering representation of yourself and kind of freed people up to be more experimental and just like, I don't know, imaginative and not so locked down to what people would think of them. So I felt like that was helpful, not only just to get to know each other's classmates and kind of like establish that trust in the classroom, but just to not be so concerned about what that image was going to look like. And then I taught a design class for the first time this fall. So that was interesting, challenging.
Is design a part of your practice?
Well, it's a part of all visual communication. So I think it's really helpful, especially for photographers to have that vocabulary and be able to talk about imagery beyond the content. Because I feel like photographs are always kind of like wedded to the content that they're showing, which is important, but it's not like the only kind of force at work as you're looking at imagery. So I feel like it's kind of freeing to be able to expand your like perspective in that way. So it's actually a requirement for the some of the certificates at the photo department. And sadly, on the one hand, I don't have a class section this semester because there are kind of some cuts, budget cuts that are happening at City College, which is a total bummer because it's such a like valuable resource in the city. And it totally changed my like course of how I was able to make a living as a photographer, just with those like super basic skills, but also just, it is like lifelong learning, but it gives people, I think, structure and something to show up to when other things seem like they're sort of falling apart in your life. And it was like, I'd be working at the low-income housing building, and I remember this gentleman passed away, and my boss had told me that we were going to like do a once-over on his room before his family looked at it, which I thought was kind of messed up, but there were like maggots and porn and all this other stuff, and the trash bag that I had busted on the stairs as I was going down. So I was like late to class and trying to gather up all this totally disgusting stuff. But even just like making it to class, even if it was late or whatever, it was just and instantly I was, you know, it might have taken a little while to adjust to being there, and I might have been like really hungry and distracted and tired, but it really gave me kind of this like foothold into something completely different from what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I see that in, as an instructor, how valuable that is for people. There's a woman who had two toddlers, and it was an all-day Saturday class, which was like really intense.
Yeah.
And she totally prioritized the rest of her week around this class because it was like her time away from her family and doing something for herself. And it was like, even if there had been, you know, an earthquake or something, I feel like she would have been there because it was like her time. So I hope that the cuts don't continue so that it prevents people from having access to that, because I think it's really important.
Had someone tell me that if I decided to stay here a little bit longer, that I should take
Yeah, I mean, it's a great facility. There's a dark room, huge dark room there. I don't think I'm just nostalgic about it because I participate in the present with it and I see that it's still valuable. So
yeah, totally. With the low income housing and how you're talking about how it, you were interested in what was there before, like the tech moved in, and like kind of maintaining those stories, are there any that you feel like have been lost in the city that you know of or that you touched?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you went to the Women's March.
I did not.
Well, Saturday's like my big portrait shooting day here in the Tintype studio, because that's when people seem to be most available. So I was like, had appointments, but I blocked off like a couple hours in the middle of the day because I always miss it because I'm always shooting, or I've missed it for the last 2 years. At the rally, there was two women from the Coalition on Homelessness who were speaking. One of them is their policy director, and then another woman was the community member. And both of them, I thought, spoke really accurately and passionately to all the voices that just never come to the table. So it's like you talk about kind of equality or Me Too movement or whatever it is, and you want to include women, that there's still like homeless women and these voices that never are quite brought to the table, and how important and powerful it is to include kind of this broader perspective of whose voices we listen to and that we don't even think about. And so I feel like that just happens consistently, you know, for along all different types of socioeconomic and demographic and racial lines, especially in San Francisco. So it was, I was really inspired by that reminder to such a large audience that they're there kind of like down for the cause, but to kind of broaden who they're really thinking about including in this kind of fight. And so it's more of that, I think, where everybody's presence here is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually this watch and jewelry repair. I don't know if you can see it. It's tiny. Mm-hmm. It's like a little shoebox. And it is just packed like wall to wall with all kinds of trinkets and curios and jewelry and watches. And he does, Tony repairs watches there. And like everything from your grandmother's house and her grandmother's house, and like just things, items that you would remember that don't necessarily have any value, but are around and remind you of what you've seen in the past. You can't see all of them at one time. So he really puts a lot of like thought and innovation to how he's going to display them so that you can see as many as possible.
Yeah.
At the same time. And so he has like styrofoam for stick pins, but like thicker styrofoam for longer lapel pins. And then he made this like grate for other types of pins, just different things for spoons. Like no one really collects spoons anymore.
Yeah.
I have a relationship with them and I photographed a lot of like what's in their store and them, but I feel like making room for even the stuff that doesn't really have any value on a larger scale is kind of like a metaphor for just like everybody has a place and there's like everybody can be seen. I kind of think of that as like part of what I'm interested in with my photography, but it's really hard to organize.
Yeah.
And I'm not very good at organizing. Mm. Finally, like, realized that about myself. I used to put it on my resume that I'm like really organized, but I'm not.
I feel like everyone does.
Yeah, I would not put it on my resume. Yeah.
So in terms of like making space for everyone, I'm assuming you also feel that way about some of the new people coming in? Like,
well, I mean, I feel like that can get really simplified in terms of these polar opposites of new and old, even and rich and poor, which exist.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, for example, this corner is a little bit of an anomaly in San Francisco because it's a transit intersection. So there's tons of people who come through here, and it really is a spectrum demographically and socioeconomically of people commuting and passing through and people who live here and work here. And, you know, I'm in a building that is artist studios that is like right on the corner of all of that transit intersection. So I know it's not going to be around forever as
yeah.
artist studios, but I'm in a fortunate position because my Tintype Studios appointment only. So I'm not relying on foot traffic. You know, I don't have to have a sign, and I purposely don't because I am probably by nature secretive or like don't like to put signs out there, but that's like a luxury, you know, for people to be able to find me through the internet and not as passersby. But a lot of the businesses here, some of which have been here for a long time, are actually experiencing this like decline where people aren't spending their money in this neighborhood. They're going to like fancier, busier, more hip parts of the city. And so they're struggling to like even keep their business open.
Yeah.
When I first moved in here 5 years ago, I felt like, you know, there was kind of room to breathe because it felt a little more normalized. And
I guess that's what I meant too when I got here. I'm like, it feels nicer out here.
It does. But I think that it's really a struggle for a lot of businesses, and even a business like Safeway, it's like their lowest grossing Safeway. So they don't invest into their store.
Right.
So I just feel like it's peculiar because disinvestment is what allows a lot of people to stay here. And I, you know, including myself, and I'm sort of by nature inclined to, especially given the pace of what's happened in San Francisco and other cities around the country. But I also, I mean, small businesses in general, I think, are really struggling in the city. There's so many restaurants that have closed.
Yeah.
I think it's really challenging to not be part of a booming industry or and make a living. And I mean, I also struggle, but I kind of acknowledge all of the things that I have going for me that allow me to kind of stay afloat.
Yeah.
And one of them is to be able to teach. So that kind of diversifies my income a little bit, but it also takes a lot of my time. So,
yeah, I want to talk about that, but sticking with the neighborhood, do you foresee some of the wealth spreading this way in the nearish future? Or do you think it's only really doing that opposite?
I mean, eventually,
yeah.
But I think I don't know when. And I think that when you are struggling to pay your bills, it's like not everybody can hold on
right.
that long.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you're working all the time.
And also housing prices
yeah.
go up even further when that happens.
Yeah. And so if people are living in Oakland, they might not necessarily want to be commuting to make a, you know, very average wage.
So going back to your practice, what all are you doing these days? Like, what's your work look like?
Oh, what do I do like on a regular basis?
You teach, you have the Tintype Studio. What is what does the balance look like? How much of each are you doing?
Well, like I said, this semester, this is kind of like the first month where I'm not teaching. I'm just managing the lab at City College, 2 days a week. And then I have been fortunate that I've had more appointments this month too. So several will be sprinkled throughout the week, and I have Saturdays. I used to work in the lab on Saturdays, so last semester I was teaching, and then when the semester started, I was at the Recology residency. So that was like a ton of work, and then ramping up for the show that they have at the end. Mm. And I had amassed a lot of stuff. Yeah. So just like dealing with that took so much time and energy, and then trying to get the show together. So I didn't really get a chance to even get my documentation finalized from that show. I feel like even though I'm bummed about kind of the direction, and I hope it doesn't continue where I don't have classes at City College, I'm really looking forward to having a little bit of time to kind of like catch up on what I didn't get to do after Recology. And there are a lot of ideas of stuff that I started that I didn't really get to pursue. So I'm trying to prioritize that. And there's a book I want to make. So I'm trying to look at that as like sectioning off a certain hours of the week as though I were teaching, so that I kind of make sure that I am keeping some, protecting that time.
For the residency, did that come with, if you don't mind me asking, was that like stipend too, or is it just like free studios based on show?
It's one of the more coveted residencies because you are kind of like an employee of Recology during that time, and you're giving public tours on like many during the week. So they're sort of compensating you for that time, and they don't have like a huge materials budget, but they're a really supportive staff to the artists there. It's a really wonderful program. So yeah, that definitely helped, especially in the summer months, because the summer class is a lot fewer hours than a regular semester class. And I did manage to sell, I don't usually typically sell that much work, but I did sell some pieces from that show that also really helped.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear more about your work outside of the Tentate
studio.
Yeah. Because you were showing me some like rad stuff, and you did the series with the cars too.
Yeah. That was the Q-Sites project where I collaborated with my partner, Vero Mahano, and then DJ Brown Amy was our third collaborator. And we basically reshot and recast all of the album covers to the East Side Story compilation albums. So there's 12 volumes, and Brown Amy DJed this soul dance party called Hard French. So there were a lot of people from that community that participated in the shoots, who also had like a history with the music, and it's kind of like lowrider oldies. And both Vero and Amy had grown up with that music, and it's kind of like there's so much nostalgia and like longing in those songs that it was kind of the soundtrack to their like desires and fantasy that wasn't really able to be shown or acted on at that particular moment. At its best, it was a really wonderful kind of bridge and coming together of a lot of different communities, because Vero's cousin helped hook us up with different car clubs to get the different car models. So at the photo shoots, there were kind of these multiple communities coming together of like the lowrider car owners and the models and then us. And I took all the portraits all on film. Then at the opening itself, it was just so many people, but from so many different parts of San Francisco. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So we were just high on that, you know, of like what was possible. And we had a dedication wall so people could dedicate to their friends or loved ones or families. And then there was this total backlash, and it was like really discouraging for all three of us, just because it was, you can't just say it's cultural. It was just like straight up homophobia. Kind of like my culture is not couture was what people were saying, that there never been any queer lowriders, like basically that this never existed. And there was a mural by the Maricon Collective from LA that was displayed on the side of the gallery, Galleria de la Raza, they are not there anymore as of like a couple of weeks ago. And it featured three cholos and cholas not doing anything, but just present. And it was vandalized several times. And so they kept putting the mural back up and we participated in that until they finally burned the side of the building and set fire to the mural.
Do you know who it was?
No, they never caught him. They were all, you know, covered up. But just, like, it was such an extreme measure to take to, like, make this statement.
Yeah.
That is really based on, like, a falsehood, as though this is not a presence that is, like, right in front of them.
Right.
And I think that that idea of, like, something that's present, but you can't actually, you can't see it until something intervenes for you to be able to see it, is what I'm interested in using, kind of like the mechanics and materials of photography to point to. And that's why I'm so excited about, like, these neons and plastics and installations of the imagery, so that it's really, like, guiding that experience and pointing people to, like, that interaction. I mean, the best part of it, it's how people come together after things like that happen. So there's a big gathering that was really moving and encouraging. And we did an artist talk. This was, like, almost 4 years ago now. Hard to imagine.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were sharing stories of how they, like, really saw themselves or family members through the images. So all of that was, like, beautiful, but it was just a drag.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, in 2015 at that time, for that to still just be so prevalent.
Yeah.
And it's almost like no shame in that type of prejudice.
Right.
And, you know, that was before Trump and everything else. It was just kind of like, there's a lot more that's sort of at the surface now, or, like, at least talked about. But at that particular point, it was like the marriage equality had just come out. And so it was backlash, I guess, against that.
Right. Were you, so there were people who kind of stood up after the backlash and were like,
oh, totally.
You, I'm queer. And
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, of course. But it was discouraging and kind of like, threatening, you know.
Yeah. I know that's hard to say, but do you feel like if that project happened now, the backlash would be louder, or do you think it would be lesser?
I mean, I think that we're in such divided times that it's like people feel emboldened either way, which is both good and bad, you know. And some of the images are going to be in an exhibit at the Oakland Museum. It's part of Queer California is the show. And then Chris Vargas has this museum of transgender herstory, I think is what it's called. Anyway, so we're part of that exhibit.
Cool. Last question for you. I always say that and then ask more. But what's something you're excited about today?
Today, I'm excited about the neon colors that I've been working with the collodion. Somebody saw, I had this pink up here, and somebody who was getting their portrait taken was like, God, at least it's not on that awful Miami Vice pink. I'm like, okay,
Aww, fair enough. So what would something like that result in, like using that?
Well,
on total?
This is blue.
Oh, okay.
So
gotcha.
You can see the negative there.
Yeah.
And then when it's in front of, basically, all of the shadow areas are filled in with the color, but it has to be against a darker background to be able to see it.
And so does it, like, it end there, or does that then get printed on a paper? Or, like,
I haven't. I'm kind of interested in ways of, like, playing with how the light interacts with them.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm also really excited about just, like, showing chaos. So I have and overlaying, like, chaotic designs over different imagery.
Cool.
So I have some of those there. It's kind of hard to see, but
okay. I think that does it.
Cool. Well, thanks.
Thank you.